Thanks, Tim.
Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. So, Tim said it. It's hot. Now we can move on. Move on to the next moment. So, I think I'll start with a poem today. And it's called We Don't See. We don't see what we're missing because we don't look into each other's eyes. The silence isn't quiet. It's because we aren't listening. The scent of the flowers pass us by, lost in the winds of time. The touch of the waters isn't felt as it flows past. Excuse me. We've become numb. Your heart feels sorrow, and mine isn't any greater than yours. Inside is where you'll find me. Inside is where I find you. Imagination is all you need. So, it's not profound, really, but it speaks to how we often operate. We're always inside our heads, often inside our heads, and we don't notice. We don't notice the scent of the flowers, and we don't listen. We don't see because we're inside our heads, inside our thoughts. So last night I went for a walk around Lake Harriet after dark when it was a little bit cooler. And there were a lot of people over there. There were a very large group of people. And that's what I noticed first of all. And trying to avoid the crowds a little bit. And I went to one of my favorite places, which is the Rose Gardens and the Perennial Gardens there. And I brought myself to the moment. And I really looked at the flowers and at their shapes and at their colors. And I was grateful for the watering that was obviously being done by the folks who work for the parks. And as I was walking along, I think it's the west side of the lake, I thought I saw fireflies. I thought I saw 1, 2, 3 fireflies. And I don't know, have any of the rest of you seen fireflies in the city? Yeah, so see, it might have been my imagination. But what a nice thing to dream up if it's my imagination. They were a bit dim. That's why I think they were real, because they weren't real bright like the fireflies we have at Hokkyoji. And there weren't very many of them. They were just, but they were there. And I think they were there. I'm not sure, but they cheered me up, or they gave me a little bit of hope. You know, because I don't know about you, but all this hot weather gets me started worrying, you know, about climate change and the desertification, the future water wars. You hear about these things, and we're seeing a drought. We're seeing the plants look parched, and it's worrisome. You know, I worry about it. So, I would imagine you also do. So the title of this talk today. Let me say something about longing. I want to say something about longing. I think as human beings, we have longing, and we long for We long for a better world. We long for an environment that is restored to its former glory. We long for abundant water and nice weather. We have all kinds of longings. Some of them are universal, and they're like bodhisattva longings, like we long to live in peace and harmony with each other and in community. And some are personal longings, but I think it's human to long for what we don't have right here, right now. And also, we're very contradictory, so we can long for peace and harmony in our community, our Zen community, in our neighborhood, in our country, but at the same time, we just want to be left alone to do our own thing. We want to just do what we want to do. We sometimes don't want to do the work of engagement with, which it takes to create peace and harmony. Something we have to create. You know, I read all kinds of things about health. I've read so many books and articles about health and about what you should eat to be healthy. At the same time, I just want to eat whatever tastes good and what's right in front of me, you know. So that's how we are, you know. We're all like that. And my talk today is about the ancestors. It's about, it's called All Beings Are Our Ancestors. And I think the ancestors have something to say to us now about how we work with our contradictory nature, you know, our double nature, our contradictory longings and behavior, and even our dualistic thinking, the way our thinking, our basic thinking is wired. So a lot of this is from the class, the Monday night class. I'll start. I'd like to read you a quote from Hangzi. Hangzi lived from 1090 to 1157, 100 years before Dogen Zenji, whom many of you know and have heard of. You've heard of Dogen. We have a class coming up. Leah Lewis is teaching on Dogen, and he's our main guy here in Soto Zen, Dogen, our Japanese ancestor. And I look for things to inspire me to practice. Because like Tim said, I no longer have to do certain things here, you know. I'm not subject to the requirements I was when I was in training. So now I have to motivate myself to practice, to keep going every day and inspire myself. And so I've looked to the ancestors for inspiration, and I really like Hongzhi. So here's a quote from his practice instructions. All beings are our ancestors. Fully appreciate the emptiness of all dharmas. Then all minds are free, and all dusts evaporate in the original brilliance that shines everywhere. Transforming according to circumstances, meet all beings as your ancestors. So this is inspiring to me. And his practice instructions consist of two elements: fully appreciating emptiness through sitting practice. It's usually how we can best appreciate emptiness, right? And working with our conditioning, which he calls dust, which I think is interesting, don't you, Tim? I mean, considering Huineng and his refutation of the term dust, he said there's no dust, no mirror for the dust to alight in the story about how he became the sixth ancestor. So, and he really admired and always pointed back to Huineng and also to Shitu and Dongshan. So Dogen referred to Hongzhe as old Buddha. He really respected him. And Dogen's turning the light inward. Some of you know about the Fukan Zazengi. He talks about turning the light inward as a metaphor for what we do when we sit down and face the wall. And Hongzhe's term is silent illumination. Silent illumination. And that Zazen that we do today is it harkens back to these teachings of silent illumination. So he was part of the 20th generation of Zen ancestors. And his silent illumination includes gratitude toward the lineage of teachers who transmitted the living heart of this tradition. And the a ritual, a practice in the morning service at Soto Zen monasteries of reciting the names of the ancestors. And this came from Hongzhe, reciting the names. And revering and feeding one's ancestors, ancestral spirits is part of Chinese culture, Japanese culture, all the Far Eastern cultures and other and indigenous cultures as well. And we Americans think that's a little weird. We don't do that so much. Maybe we go and, you know, tend the graves of our ancestors, and we do keep pictures of them around. And some people like to do little rituals to remember the ancestors and their bloodlines. But it's a very Far Eastern cultural kind of thing. I think it's beautiful. I like that during a formal session, the Tenzo puts out an offering every day, you know, after the meal for the hungry spirits, the hungry ghosts, you know. Who knows if they're there, but they might be, and if they are, we should feed them, right? So the lives and the teachings of the ancestors provide a picture of how our Zen tradition sees itself. And there's a lot of controversy out there about whether some of these people even existed, you know, but there is some historical record. It's pretty sketchy on Bodhidharma, the first of the ancestors, but there are some writings left behind. And then we use our imagination to fill in the details. I don't know if any of you have read the book The Buddha by Karen Armstrong. Have any of you read that? Yeah, I think we used it here in a class. In a class we offered on the Buddha, and that's an example of a book that's written using the historical record, but also using filling in with a very informed imagination. Karen Armstrong has a depth to her practice and her life that allows her to... She's written biographies of many of the major religious leaders, so not just Buddha. But that's an example of an informed use of imagination. So Hongzhe's practice instructions synthesize the teachings of the Kaodong, which is the Chinese term for the Soto lineage, and the Soto lineage is our lineage. Not that you have to worry about that, but yeah, you might be interested. And important to his philosophy are the works of Dongshan and Shitu. And Matsu and Shitu both lived in the 8th century, so kind of, we're looking backwards. Like Hongzhe looked backwards, you know, to the ancestors that came before him. And Matsu, in 8th century China, and Shitu lived at the same time as each other. And they didn't really interact with each other, but they were the main guys. And the practice at that time for monks in China, and Zen had been there, Chan, it was called, had been in China for already a couple hundred years. But these ancestors that we're focusing on are representative of the pioneers of Zen, of a new look. The way Chan was practiced before Bodhidharma and Weining and the others was meditation was involved. It was not as central. Just sitting was not as central as it is now, or as it became later. But there was sitting, and there was ritual, and there was translating texts, and building monasteries. Those were the main activities before these guys. So in the 8th century, Shi Tu and Dong Shan both lived, and they taught, and they met with students. And they had slightly different styles, and I'll get into that in a little bit. I want to read some more of Hongzhi's practice instructions. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. That's our inherent, bright, awakened mind, which eludes our grasping, but is very close. It's like the nose on our face and we can't see it because it's so close. You must purify, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you've fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. So, purify, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies. So that this is, it's two parts, this teaching has two parts. The awareness of our original nature, the brightness of our original nature, the emptiness of our original nature, at the same time making the effort to work with our conditioning, which as soon as we sit down on the cushion, there it is. All our conditioning, the way we think, you know, the way we feel, the axes we're grinding, the whatever it is that's going on is right there. So just sitting is actually purifying, grinding down, and brushing away the dust of our conditioning. I mean, because what else is there to do when you're sitting, right? So we can't destroy it. That grind down is a little misleading, I think. I think grinding down refers to just being with, again and again and again, so often that it begins to wear away. We begin to see the thoughts, you know, the top 10 complaints and the whining, and we see it and we get tired of it. And so that's grinding down, as we just get tired of it. The more we see it, the more we look at it, and just let go with the out-breath. Let go. And have the intention to keep letting go, then that's grinding down the dust. So both are important, and both are part of his practice instructions, and they're also what we do today. And that's really helpful. It's really helpful to do that. It doesn't mean they'll never come back, these dusts, but it just makes us easier to be with. Easier to be with ourselves, easier to be with each other. And we lighten up. We lighten up and release and relax. And that's kind of the... that's kind of the practice that is personified by Shi Tu in his song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, is relaxing, letting go, releasing, and both on the cushion and then out in the world, constantly transforming ourselves according to conditions. So whatever comes up, between me and Marty is another opportunity for Marty and I to see our own conditioning and to let it go. And then we start anew with each other immediately, transforming according to conditions. And the central paradox of the instructions is effortless effort. So the idea is to make an effort, but to do it effortlessly, to not get caught in that trap of, I'm just going to do this, I'm going to really work hard on myself, I'm going to become a better person, I'm going to be a much better version of myself, right? It's still a self. it's still creating something, and whenever we try to create something, then what's really there, that bright circle, is far from us the minute we do that. So somehow we have to find a way to do this practice so that we're just doing it. Like Katagiri said, just get up, just brush your teeth, just sit down, do it like you brush your teeth. I'm sure all of you have really good oral hygiene and that you brush your teeth at least once a day or twice a day, and that's a good metaphor for you, as it is for me, just like brushing your teeth. Of course, we can find ways to forget things, right, like sitting. So that's the paradox. It also... Hongzhi's instructions also harken back to Shi Tu's harmony of difference and unity, or difference and sameness, which Tim's been talking about. I've been listening to your talks, by the way, enjoying them. He's been talking about for months. Are you almost done? Anyway, that poem expresses the harmonizing of these two ways, the harmonizing of difference and unity, of our internal contradictions and paradox, like the front and the back foot in walking. There's no, you know, start and middle and end. It's just always going, always moving, always changing. And we can cultivate a mind that's flexible through seeing the darkness but not labeling it darkness. Seeing the light but not labeling it light. So to do this work, because our egos and our clinging is tenacious and our habits, we need a community, a container, a practice and a community like we have here. And a commitment. We need a commitment. Yeah, it doesn't just happen. It's not, you know, some people think of Zen as just going with the flow and everything's chill and it is what it is and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And those ideas are, well, there's a little bit of truth to them. There's a little kernel of truth to them, but it takes more effort than that. It takes individual effort and commitment. We have to make that. So, hey, if you become a priest, then you'll be forced to do it. So, you know, in order to stay a priest, so, you know, there's a there's a plan. Oh, boy. So we do these two practices today that the ancestors presented, which are cutting through, and engaging. And Shi Tu and Matsu personify those two styles. I think they did both, but they personify those two styles. And Matsu especially symbolizes the cutting through. And he was known for cutting off his students' minds before they could even say anything. He didn't even let them speak. He hit him, or he did something. He shouted. And we don't like that today because it sounds violent. But sometimes I imagine being a monk in those times And they were heady times, and you traveled from teacher to teacher, and people would tell you, oh, you really need to go see Shi Tzu in that hut, that little hut, that grass hut. Or they'd say, you better go see Ma Tzu. I can tell you need to go see Ma Tzu. So they would, and the two masters would send their students to each other as well. And these encounter dialogues in the case books, and here's one example, the Gateless Barrier. There's the Blue Cliff Record. There's the Book of Serenity. And the Book of Serenity is, Hongzhi is credited with that collection and the verses in it, compiling it. I'll read you a case in this featuring Ma Tzu. As a young monk, he trained at the monastery of Nanyue, the Dharma's successor, the next person after Hui Ning. He was one of several hundred monks at the monastery, lost in the crowd, unknown to his teacher. A senior monk noticed his diligence, however, and mentioned him to Nanyue. The old teacher sought him out and found him in the Zendo doing Zazen by himself. Nanyue asked, Reverend Sir, what is your purpose in doing Zazen? Ma Tzu answered, I seek to become a Buddha. Nanyue thereupon took a piece of roofing tile and began rubbing it with a stone. You've heard this one, some of you. Ma Tzu asked, what are you doing, venerable teacher? Nanyue said, I want to polish this roofing tile and make a mirror. Ma Tzu asked, can a piece of roofing tile be made into a mirror? Nanyue said in return, can a Buddha be created by doing Zazen? Ma Tzu was dumbfounded and could not reply. There was nothing he could say. Nanyue then went on, it's like hitching an ox to a cart when the cart doesn't move. Do you beat the ox or the cart? Ma Tzu still couldn't reply. So he explained further, are you doing Zazen or are you sitting as Buddha? Are you sitting as Buddha? See, there's a hint, right? Doing something to make something or just being Buddha itself. Zazen is not just a matter of sitting or lying down. Sitting as Buddha reveals that Buddha has no fixed form. In the midst of transitory things, don't grasp or reject. If you keep the Buddha seated, this is murdering the Buddha. If you cling to the form of sitting, you don't adhere to its inner principle. So, that's one of those famous stories about that give us a hint about how we can practice and what we can avoid, what we should try to avoid. Clinging, grasping or rejecting, clinging to a form or ignoring the form altogether, just going with the flow. In other places in the literature, the Zen masters of this time talk about their ability, each other's ability to take lives. Here we go with more murdering and killing again. Or cause their disciples to lose their life. And those are metaphors. Because what they're causing their disciples to do is lose their prior understanding of life. Lose their stuck place, their spot that they congealed around. That's what they're causing them to lose, not their actual lives. They're not actually killing them. So it's a metaphor for awakening. Awakening as letting go rather than as gaining something new. So we have these ceremonies here sometimes called Shuso or head monk. And it's kind of fun. I think it's kind of fun. And there are ritual elements, and then there's an element of total spontaneity at the same time. So the shuso is given. The shuso is just a student that's ready, according to the teacher, to be the head monk, to play this role, and to be questioned in something that's sometimes called dharma combat, and to answer those questions. And yet it, to me, at least the way we do it here at Sensen, it never seems like combat. It rather seems like a dance, like a improv. And there are ritual elements to it, but it's also what happens is that we create the teaching together with this ceremony, and it's very spontaneous and it's very warm actually, and it's fun. So the shuso is given, recites, is given a staff called the shuso staff, and recites a verse that's traditional. Part of the recitation says that they're holding a vajra sword that can give and take life. And so the vajra is an object that symbolizes wisdom in its manifestation of cutting through delusion. It's the cutting through is the wisdom that comes through cutting through our conditioning, our clinging, our ideas about things, our feelings that we're holding on to. And it's a bit like these dialogues. So if you get a chance in the future here, you should go to one. They're fun, and they are acting out this way of encounter between teacher and student. The shuso, the head student, plays the teacher, and everyone else plays the student and tries to ask a question from the heart. And occasionally, a question is asked that where the person tries to stump the other person, but it's not that common, not here. So why should we care about this? That's a question I'll ask. Why should we care about this way of inquiring into what's really happening beyond our ideas about what's happening? Should I attempt an answer? Or do you want to? Tim, do you want to say why we should care about this? No. Well, good, because I have some ideas. So, recently I encountered some interesting articles about what was happening in 8th century China when Matsu and Shitu were living. And there are some parallels for our time. At that time in history in China, there was happening something called the An Lushan Rebellion. China was getting, it had all these city-states and its borders needed protecting, and the leaders asked the farmers to come and help defend the borders, which meant that food didn't, crops didn't get grown, and people started to go hungry, and they called in foreign mercenaries to help defend its borders from warring states. And one of these mercenaries became close to the wife of the emperor and staged a rebellion and basically took over as the emperor at that time. And there was a lot of bloodshed and a lot of violence and hunger and a loss of life, to the tune of 2 out of 3 Chinese died. So that's huge. I never knew about that. I'm just learning things. So that's a really large-scale disaster. And it was during this time that Shitu lived in his grass hut on top of a flat rock, and people came to him to talk to him. And I imagine, we can imagine that they came with all kinds of pain and sorrow and loss and maybe even feelings of vengeance. So they would go to Matsu's monastery, or they'd go to see Shi Tu, because he didn't teach in a monastery till later in life. And we can imagine, we can use our imagination as to how was it? How did they try to help him? In light of such awful times, what did these teachers say to them? And I'd like to read to you a piece from this article by a woman called Roshi Joan Sutherland, and what she has to say about this. And what she says, and what she has to say about these times that we're living in, and how we can engage and not turn away. Or when we do turn away, come back again. Come back, come back. We don't reject our own thoughts and feelings, even in a desperate time. The grieving, the rage, the flashes of bravery and generosity in ourselves and in others, all of that is the way too. Even, maybe especially, the mind that doesn't understand is exactly it. It's a good time to be asking questions, to appreciate the grounding of the ordinary mind and its impulses to make a warm breakfast on a cold day, and to research what it would take to become carbon neutral. In other words, there's a unity between our inner lives and the outer world, a continuum that only appears to be separated into pieces that are sometimes in conflict. This is what Master Ma called living a natural life according to the times. Be part of what's going on around you, and just wear clothes, eat food, always and always uphold the way of the Bodhisattva. Oh, sure, nothing to it, right? According to Shi Tu, your essential mind is absolutely still and completely whole, and its ability to respond to circumstances is limited. Is unlimited. Not limited. Maybe at times it's limited, but we do have a capacity to respond, you know, and these times that we're living in, just like the times they were living in, require using our imagination, being able to respond and staying in a place of balance between various forces in ourselves and outside ourselves. So, cutting off and engaging Matsu's way was cutting off, and I think Shi Tu's way was more engaging. Some of you haven't read this Song of the Grass Hermitage, so I'll share a little bit of it so you get a feeling for this. I've built a grass hut, but where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle Bodhisattva trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? And the hut? What's the hut? What does he mean by a hut? Anybody want to guess? What is the grass hut, do you think, metaphorically speaking? The body, yes, Yeah, I think it is. I think so. I think it's the body. So the middling or lowly, those parts of ourselves, can't help but wondering, will this hut perish or not? Are we going to pass out at the Twins game later on today? Can we handle it? Can we handle the next moment? Can we handle the intensity of this? We long for awakening because, partly I think because, based on my experience of myself, I can say because we hope that somehow through awakening we can transcend our personal death. Even though all the evidence suggests that that's not going to happen, we still cling to that hope. But whether that's true or not, this practice vivifies what's here and now, which is really all we have. It's really all we have is this moment and the next moment. We can't awaken in the moment that just happened. We have to awaken now. We have to be awake. Just be awake. Be Buddha now. And that's enough, I think. Well, it has to be. It has to be enough. But I think it is enough. And it's abundant. And when we bring ourselves to the moment and really look at the flowers and really hear the birds sending the call down the line to each other, as I did last night, then the present moment unfolds in a way, in its fullness, and there's everything we need there. And so then our task is just to stay in our moments and enjoy our moments, as Tim would say, enjoy our moments. And I have to say, I have a romantic view about where I live in my yurt, that I'm like Shitu. And there it is. That's my hut. It's not made out of grass. It's made out of canvas and wood. But I have to admit I'm drawn to him because I imagine myself as Shitu, you know, a hermit, and I have this hut, and there's nothing of value, and if it were to burn down, then I'm sure I would feel terrible and feel like there was plenty of value in there, but it's a nice romantic fantasy I have that I identify with she too in this grass hut where I live now. And I hope that I can engage completely with whoever comes to my hut to see me, and whoever I come to see, and with this time that we live in, and catch myself when I'm wanting to turn away and withdraw into my own little personal shell. That's always a choice. We always have a choice. But if we hang out with good people, like each other, then we're really encouraging each other to stay with it. Stay with it, but take care of the body. Take care of the hut at the same time. So a balance is good. So that's what I have to say today, this morning. And I'm happy to be here with you and in Minneapolis, the beautiful city. And the class, you know, if you were to drop in, would be okay. We wouldn't make any special dispensation for you, but you could drop in and join the group that's meeting for the next 3. We met one time, meeting for the next 3 Monday nights. And you could bring a contribution, and you could bring your contribution, bring yourself, if you like. So that's it. thank you for listening. And if you want to discuss or fill in the blanks or ask a question, now's a good time. Kate?
So, I have chanted the Club of Grassroots Hermitage how many times? And every time it gets that 10 square feet thing, I always think, that's like 2 feet by 10 feet. I totally get stuck on that. No, 2 feet by 5 feet. I totally get stuck on that. And somehow, even though I think, well, that's like the size of a little person's body, and I still like it's like even with that big clue, I still totally wasn't really, I don't think, grasping that.
Right.
And here it is. It's like there's this big clue right in there. It's the size of a body.
Yeah. What does do you remember what hojo means, Tim? It means a hut.
Yeah, it means hut.
But I'm not sure what the dimensions of the hut are.
I think it means a 10 by 10 hut.
10 by 10 hut?
I think so.
Yeah.
We could look it up.
We could look it up.
We could get our iPhones up.
Oh. Who's got one? Who's got one? It's a little arcane. The Katagiri Roshi, at some point in time, in the past, he expressed some discomfort with being called Roshi. People would say, Roshi, Roshi. You know, when you asked a question after a talk, he'd say, Roshi. And he wasn't so altogether comfortable with that title. I think it means old teacher. Old teacher. Maybe he didn't like being considered old. I don't know. But I think it was that we Americans were making a really big deal out of that title. And so he said, just call me Hojo-san. So and I think that might be traditional because they now call Shohaku Okumura Hojo. Hojo or Hojo-san is, san is an honorific, like we call Tomoe, Tomoe-san. So, yeah.
That's why it's 2 feet by 5.
Maybe sitting upright, not laying down. Jeff.
You asked why I care?
Why do we care about what these teachings and about these practices?
You are in charge of the great matter.
Exactly, yeah.
And the great matter is birth and death. And we have to be thoroughgoing. I think, the grass hut is lovely, but there's terror in this also, I think. I'm very fortunate. My particular life involves a lot of dance, and I find myself in a dance studio frequently where the teacher has just sketched out this complicated sequence of movements, and we're supposed to be performing them down the diagonal of the studio with one or two or three other people, and the count is going, and you know that in 8 counts you have to go out there and do it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you don't really remember half of it.
It's like giving a Dharma talk.
But as far as the grass hut is concerned, I mean, all you have is your own personal, in my case, 70-year-old grass hut. Not somebody else's.
Not somebody else's. Nobody can do it for you. Take your place.
That's right.
That's right, yeah. Oh, that's great. Thanks. And he does say, I think, at the end of the poem, don't waste time. Doesn't he say that at the end? I got it with me. By night and by day. Now he says, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. This skin pegs this body. Don't separate from it. Be in it. But there is that is that part of harmony of difference and sameness?
Yep, it's the last one.
It's the last line of that one, which is also a shitus. Don't waste time. So, at the same time, live inside timelessness. But don't waste time because nobody else can do it for you. That's right. It's a good reminder for me too, for all of us.
Contradictory nature, and I thought it was a kind of dualistic nature, and I was wondering what you mean by a contradictory nature.
Well, I was using the example of our longings. You know, we have, what would it be like if we met with a teacher and his skillful means or her skillful means just cut right through our longing? We kind of love our longing, you know, but we really love it. We're attached to it. It seems, it's something that feels like it's really part of our humanity. And we don't want to, we fear, amongst our many fears, our complete nothingness, you know. We fear emptiness because we think of it as some blank, a hole we fall into with nothingness and no, completely alone, you know, like some science fiction scenario in a cold world with no other human beings. We have that fear. But so what would it be like? What would we be like without our longing, you know? I don't know if we would even be human. I wonder about that. You know, but the example was that our longings are contradictory. We want peace and harmony with others, but we want to be left alone and not bugged. You know, we want to be really super healthy, but we just want to lay on the couch with the air conditioning on and watch television. You know, just those are just the little examples. It's just the way we are. You know, we can laugh at it a little and then, you know, engage with it. So, okay, I think that's good, and I thank you again, and turn it over to Sean.